happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you on board today. We're going to be exploring a lot of health issues, how to live a longer life. We're also going to be having a guest that I'm giving more attention to in the second part of our program because I'm offering a legitimate and measured challenge to the New York Times and to the mainstream media, to the Hollywood community, because we are going to present information today from an award-winning investigative journalist, Vanessa Bealey. She'll be on Skype from France. She's traveling to the Middle East, and we will try to deconstruct the argument that the Syrian civil defense group, also known as the White Helmets, is a charitable and benevolent organization. No reporter for the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, no one in the United States has gone into that territory when they were doing their so-called humanitarian work and filmed them. But one person was there, my guest. And she will tell you the truth, and she is a top, tough journalist. We're also going to explore other issues today. I'm going to take you on the beginning of a journey. It will begin today. It probably will take months to fully unfold. I'm going to take you step by step to identify those who are part of the hidden hand, the group of oligarchs and extremely powerful, wealthy people and the corporations they control, and how they select the people for the various government positions. I think this is important because I'm seeing from the left hatred, negativity, and reactions. I'm seeing from the right hatred, negativity, and reactions, neither of which will help resolve any of our conflicts and problems with the environment, with income inequality, with dire poverty, with starving children, with endless wars. None of this, and none of the people involved, have done or will do anything that will make a difference. Why not? Once I complete this series, you'll have a better understanding. This is real scholarship. Everything I will share with you will be fully footnoted, no hidden sources, everything transparent. It begins today. Also today, enemies of the state, how the financial services industry is destroying democracy. Graham Van Bergen from the European Financial Review. Also today, we're going to have some audio clips. And by the way, we're just finishing our studios over the next 2 days, moving our offices and studios, and we're adding a whole new video capacity. So when I say we're going to an audio clip, you will then be able to watch it over the internet as well as hear it. And all my guests in the future that are on Skype or in any television show, you'll be able to see it. We're adding this giant monitor in our brand new studio. So even though I'm out of town, they'll be playing an audio clip as video, so you'll get to see it. So that's something brand new we're adding. And we've added 10 more phone lines for you to be able to listen to this program live at noon, Monday to Friday, Tuesday evening at 7, or listen over the telephone to the archives. So that's all new because we were flooded with people this week at noon listening over the telephone. Today, we're going to have a short segment. Are we becoming the internet? Is the internet becoming us? Again, the people behind the internet are part of the hidden hand, the Googles, the Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, and these people, Bill Gates. These are the people who have extraordinary and exceptional power and influence, and without exception, they're using it against our interest. This will explain how they're doing it, and unfortunately, how we are allowing it. We're not fighting it, because we're only looking at how it benefits us, not how it benefits them and other individuals, governmental agencies in particular. The subject is too vast to cover in one show. I'm estimating it will take close to 100 programs throughout the year, not every day, but when we have something that's highly relevant, we'll be putting it on the air, showing you who really controls every aspect of our life. So that's what we have for you today. And as always, we begin with the latest on health and healing. Some new research from Northwestern University shows that the rhythm of breathing is crucial to controlling fear and emotional behavior. What do I mean by that? We live in a fearful world with exposure to a deluge of stressors every day. As much as fear is a result of reacting to the actual or perceived events in our lives, it's also a biological function of the human body. And when equipped with an understanding of how the body manages the emotional system, we can easily outsmart it, in effect, tricking ourselves into emotional balance. Now, you've heard me mention many times that every single act in life is based upon an exchange of energy, because we are, above and beyond all things, a life force. But so is a tree. So are things we thought are inanimate objects. So are things that we thought were not high in their understanding of life or its purpose or its meaning. They are not sentient beings. But in fact, the closer we get to understanding them, the more we realize, gee whiz, they do have understandings and feelings. So it's this ability to have this exchange of energy. And so what we're doing now is this perceptive understanding has now been scientifically validated by new research for Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, which discovered how the various rhythmic patterns of breath profoundly impact memory, recall, and the emotional body, specifically the fear response. Let me break this down even more. The brain creates electrical impulses which link physical functions to emotional reactions. And the electrical activity of the brain is deeply affected by our breathing. The outcome of this balance is determined by whether or not we are inhaling or exhaling, as well as if we are breathing through the nose or the mouth, as each variable creates a different electrical response within the brain. And so when we are feeling stressed, when we're angry, when we feel put upon, one of the first things we do is we change our breathing. Suddenly, instead of deep diaphragmatic breathing that relaxes us, oxygenates our blood, and creates a calming effect because it calms the hormones in our body. In effect, it keeps the cortisol, the epinephrine, the norepinephrine, the catecholamines, the adrenaline, it keeps them down and in balance. And one of the major findings of the study is that there is a dramatic difference in the brain activity in the amygdala and the hippocampus during inhalation compared to exhalation. When you breathe in, we discover you are stimulating neurons in the olfactory cortex and the amygdala and the hippocampus all across the limbic system. And that's important. And the amygdala is decisively linked to the processing of emotions, especially those related to fear. And while the hippocampus is strongly related to memory recall and the breath, which originates with the diaphragm plays a critical role in regulating their function. So, let me see if we can all understand this. Breathing is modulated at the diaphragm, and it's also the location where many physical symptoms associated with fear and anxiety manifest. How many times have you heard, "Oh, you made me sick to my stomach," or "Now I'm so upset, I can't eat, I'm not hungry"? The differences in brain activity which occurred during unique breathing rhythms were recognized by looking at brain activity during the introduction of fearful or surprising human faces and finding distinctly heightened activity during inhaling. So here's the takeaway message, and I'll just give you one little example. During the 1980s, before I became a race walker, I was a runner, and a good runner. I won a lot of races, or was one of the winners. And I knew how fast I could run. And there was a particular race where I went out real fast. And then I realized that I had gone out too fast, and my breathing changed. And with that, my energy was gone. My adrenals were overstimulated, my cortisol too high. I had the adrenal rush. And I knew that even though it was the first mile of a race, I wouldn't be able to do well the rest. And that's exactly what happened. I got slower and slower and slower, more difficult breathing. And then I said, okay, from now on, just have fun with the race. Just make it like we're training, because I have a bunch of people that we all raced and trained together. There was at one time about 50 of us running together. And we were fast, and we won virtually every race we would be in. One of us would win, and even in the Jersey Marathon. But we were used to training at five-minute paces. But if you went out too fast, suddenly your body tells you, you're going too fast. You know it even before you look at your stopwatch. And then that changes your breathing. And by changing your breathing, you now don't have that nice, even, smooth, in-the-zone breathing. I've said many times, breathing is half of what results in outstanding athletic activity, especially track and field. In any case, from then on, every race I do, including the World Games, I don't think of it as a race. I don't get excited about it. I don't get stressed about it. I just have fun with it. I make sure I control my breathing. And I look at breathing in and the fun of what I'm doing. And out, how easy it is. Fun in, easy out. In, out. Breathing. Keeping your breath deep. Filling up the lower lobes of the lungs. Getting more oxygenation. Now, what this means is that when you are in a stressful situation, instead of going up here and I'm breathing and it's all and I can't, calm it down. Breathe. Just close your eyes and breathe deep. Slow it down. Slow your breathing down. When you slow your breathing down, you're relaxing yourself. You're bringing those stress hormones down. You're oxygenating yourself, and now your brain is reacting differently again. So if you want to get out of anger, rage, fear, stress, use your breathing. The breathing is half of it, and then controlling your visualization is the other half. Positive visualization, not looking at the other as the enemy, even though you can have a difference of opinion. One person starting to yell, another person yelling louder, another person yelling louder, then screaming, then raging. Where does that lead? Always destruction. And that's where a lot of micro strokes occur. Mini strokes, we call them. So simple breathing, and it makes all the difference in the world. Also, I was asked this yesterday, so I thought I would answer it today. But this is also supported by a study from the University of Southern California. And someone was talking about secondhand smoke and how dangerous it is, because I had mentioned I grew up in a family where everyone smoked. I was the only one in my entire family, my extended family, my aunts and uncles, 18 of us, I was the only one who didn't smoke. And they thought I was, you know, funny because I didn't smoke. Because everyone smoked. Everyone on television smoked. Everyone in the movies smoked. And that was correct. And they drank and they smoked. You never saw anyone eat going out of their way to eat a healthy salad. There was never a scene in any movie, you know, here, have a healthy salad. Here, have a nice glass of juice. No, it was always whiskey and or coffee. This impacts a person's health, the secondhand smoke. But also there's new research that shows that pregnant women are also affected by secondhand sugars. They can pass through the breast milk. That's correct. This is brand new information. So add breast milk to the list of foods and beverages that contain fructose. You've heard me mention many times, it's a sweetener linked to serious health issues ranging from obesity to diabetes. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world and all the different stations carrying this. In about 12 minutes or so, 15 minutes at most, we're going to hear from our guest from France, and assuming we can make our connection over Skype, Fanisa Bealey, who will be talking about her experience in Iraq, in Iran, in Turkey, in Syria, in Israel. But she saw what was really going on. And instead of trusting a award-winning, respected journalist, they looked at a $100 million public relations campaign to sanitize the reputation of the White Helmets. Today's New York Times front page, promoting and sanitizing the White Helmets. We are going to offer a different perspective. I want to start now by giving you an overview of the hidden hands. I'll show you how simple it is. It's not complicated. As you know, many of President Trump's cabinet members, and rightly so, have been criticized for being unqualified for the positions like DeVos and some of the others. In fact, all of them are unqualified. And how they're frankly self-interested, and I would agree with that. But why weren't these same people equally critical of Obama? Let me explain something about Obama and his cabinet, which would have been Hillary Clinton's cabinet. One man, Michael Froman, F-R-O-M-A-N, who was he? He was a Citigroup executive who later served as the U.S. Trade Representative for Obama. Why is that important? Because he used to be the top person or one of the top people at Citigroup, which owns Citibank. In fact, he used his Citigroup email address. What also did he promote? He promoted the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He was the leading advisor and architect for America's input, along with hundreds of major corporations. And those people had to work with Michael Froman. But it was all done in secret, so secret that not even a member of Congress would be allowed to go in and sit down and read a copy. You had to remove all cell phones. You had to have a witness watching you. You couldn't take anything out. You could only take hand notes. And it was only because of WikiLeaks releasing some of the testimony, or some of the parts of it, that we learned how absolutely devastating the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be. Mind you, both Hillary Clinton and 44 separate discussions she had with European leaders promoting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She was a major advocate, as she has been a major advocate of every one of our treaties. And those treaties, by the way, supersede U.S. law. Now, so here we have a man from Citigroup who is the top trade representative, but it's more. He and he alone selected Obama's cabinet. And by the way, Citigroup got $476 billion of the original $700 billion TARP bailout, but later got $2 trillion in non-secured or unsecured money from the Federal Reserve. And some of the other people, and then it turns out that the Citigroup gave Obama, when he was running for president, a whole lot of money. In fact, Citigroup was the seventh largest donor to Obama in his campaign. The University of California gave $1.8 million, Goldman Sachs, Harvard, Microsoft, J.P. Morgan, and Google, all people who would be important. So then who made up the department heads? Well, Robert Gates, a Bush holdover, became Secretary of Defense. Eric Holder, Attorney General. Janet Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security. Rahm Emanuel, White House Chief of Staff. Susan Rice, U.N. Ambassador. Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education. Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services. Peter Orszag, Head of the Office of Management and Budget. Eric Shinesky, Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Melody Barnes, Chief of Domestic Policy. And then Timothy Geithner, and Secretary of Treasury, but also on the advisory Economic Advisory Board, Lawrence Summers, who had been Secretary of Treasury under Bill Clinton, one of the architects of the Glass-Steagall Act. So one man, one human being, has the power to select all corporatists, all people affiliated with major industries, and all for their benefit, because they all benefited. And all their corporations all benefited. So when we are looking at one administration for the poor selection and of its cabinet members, not one representing real populist interest, we should go back and look at the others. It shows you who really is behind the scenes, who's making the calls. Now we take one example, just one example of how this works. When Eric Holder was the Attorney General, how many of the big bank manipulators found guilty of crimes and paying fines, how many did he put in prison? None. Zero. Zip. Not one. But should they have gone to prison? Maybe they didn't do anything that bad. Well, let's just take HSBC. They were fined $1.9 billion, with a B, billion dollars. Okay. But what was the big deal? Well, minimally, HSBC failed to monitor $670 billion in wire transfers and over $9 billion in currency purchases from the Sinaloa drug cartels and other Mexican drug cartels. They never had to give back a penny of the ill-gotten gains. So almost over half a trillion dollars in drug money, drug laundering, but there were also terrorist groups that were also giving them money. Not a question asked. So the ethics of the banks have been, we only care about making money, and we only care about having it pass through our hands. We will not question the integrity of the people or where it came from. Now, since the National Security Agency monitors every single electronic transition, they knew about every single one of those. So the president's national security advisors knew that the drug cartels were laundering money into the hundreds of billions of dollars, and not a single word was said. They're sitting at the same table each morning with the attorney general. The secretary of state would have known that. Hillary Clinton, not a single thing was done to them. No, someone had to drop a dime on that and make it a public issue. Also, there is seemingly they knew of the shipment of 22 tons of cocaine. The present worth would have been about $450 million. Did nothing. Now, the FBI also alleged that the Bank of America was laundering the Los Zetos drug money out of Mexico. And also J.P. Morgan was challenged for money laundering for Mexican cartels. Also, Citigroup and Western Union, both their activities only involved those two. It was in the tens of millions, was considered non-important. But even in billions, here's what happened. A, they paid a token fine. B, no one went to jail, no one was prosecuted. C, they got to keep all of the illicit gains. And yet, you're caught smoking or caught possessing a small amount of marijuana on a search and seizures, you can go to jail for 7 years. So in the entire 8 years, not a single person went to jail. But let's go back further. During the Bush administration, same thing. How about the Clinton administration? Same thing. So you've had uninterrupted, you had 8 years, 8 years, and 8 years, and no one went to jail. No one had to give back their ill-gotten gains. Now, this is just part of it, because also in the hidden hand, you find Wall Street firms. Now, these are the firms that appear on television. Their representatives appear in all the business magazines. They are invited to give lectures before prestigious groups at different business schools and schools that focus upon economics, like the Wharton School or University of Chicago, that have good reputations. And they're right there advising the presidents, every one of the presidents. Okay, then I'm sure that they have a clean reputation, right? You and I wouldn't be invited if we had a track record of settling all kinds of lawsuits, right? Here's the homework. This is just since the meltdown. This is just in the last 9 years. Bank of America, $16.6 billion for the sale of shoddy residential mortgage-backed securities, $11.2 billion. This is how much they paid. Faulty mortgage sales, $9.5 billion, defrauding Freddie and Fannie, $8.5 billion, toxic mortgage-backed security, $2.9 billion, foreclosure abuse, $2.4 billion, false statements about Merrill Lynch Health, $1.7 billion, toxic mortgages, $1.3 billion, fraud over defective mortgages, $950 million, toxic second lien residential-backed securities, $727 million to Consumer Protection Bureau for forcing consumers to sign for extra credit cards, $650 million toxic backed security, $404 million faulty mortgages sold to Freddie and Fannie, and $228 million kickback scheme to inflate insurance costs. How many people went to jail? None. How was their stock affected? It went up. They paid the fine that went up. How much of the ill-gotten gains did they have to forfeit? None. Deutsche Bank, just this past year, Department of Justice got $7 billion to settle mortgage cases, then $1.9 billion for defrauding Fannie and Freddie, then thousands of major lawsuits settled. Credit Suisse, last year, $5 billion in mortgage settlements, then $2.6 billion for helping Americans account holdovers hide their wealth, and then other $10 billion for pending lawsuit. Goldman Sachs, $5 billion for faulty mortgages, sham mortgages. They actually bilked out $37 billion from investors and deals, $1.2 billion housing regulating lawsuit, Goldman Sachs $550 million inside betting against mortgage bonds, J.P. Morgan Chase $13 billion for sale of trouble mortgages, $1 billion for botched financial transaction traders, $1.7 billion for the Madoff victims, $13 billion for sale mortgage-backed securities, $4.5 billion faulty mortgage-backed securities to investors. Citigroup, the one who selected all of Obama's top cabinet people, the one who headed the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, the one who was the person most responsible in the world for controlling the outcome of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have destroyed all unions, destroyed all of our sovereign rights, that would have destroyed our environment, destroyed all of the regulations. That's who he is. His corporation, $7 billion they had to pay for sale of toxic mortgages, $2 billion for Enron investors, $2.6 billion for WorldCom scandal, $968 million misrepresenting quality of home loans to Fannie, and then Wells Fargo, $8.5 billion, Wells Fargo, $1.2 billion, Countrywide, $67 million. Now, those are just a token example. You're dealing with hundreds of billions, all told around $300 billion, over a quarter of $1 trillion paid in fines. Not a single person went to jail. Not a single dollar had to be returned from ill-gotten gains. These then became the top people politically in Washington who had open access lobbying to every member of Congress, who selected the cabinet for Barack Obama, who have not once been challenged on any radio or television program, have had no bad press, only positive press. That's how the hidden hand works. Now, let's say you and I decide to do some illegal things and not to deal drugs, just to possess them. You go to jail for a long time, and that record sticks with you. They commit crimes of unimaginable magnitude. Now, I haven't even got that coming up. That's chicken feed compared to the corruption in the pharmaceutical industry. And we have now 400,000 lawsuits they have settled. We're the only people in the world that have added them all up, who made them, and how not a single person went to prison because of it. And those are the people that managed to get the vaccine exemption law that protects vaccine makers so that they can never be sued, no matter how bad a vaccine is. It's all political and it's all economic. It's all about power. And I'll be showing you step by step who the enemies are and how they got to where they are, and we should be very concerned about it. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Let's go now to France. We're standing by Skype is Vanessa Bealey. She is a British investigative journalist. She is focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Gaza and Syria. She is an associate editor of 21st Century Wire and was a member of a peace-finding mission to Syria and organized by the U.S. Peace Council. Vanessa was in Aleppo during and after its liberation, after the city being captured for almost 5 years by Western United States-backed Salafists, and she is credited with having exposed the fraud behind the faux charitable volunteer organization, the Syrian Defense and Civil Defense, or better known as the White Helmets, which was nominated and then won for a short feature documentary, and today is being promoted on the New York Times front page as if it's this very special and not even controversial organization. Nice to have you with us today, Vanessa.
It's Vanessa, actually, Gary. Thank you very much for asking me on.
Vanessa, I'd like you to focus your energy, please, on concerning the background and the real mission and activities of the Syrian Civil Defense, or the White Helmets. Mm-hmm. Right now, across the United States mainstream media, the volunteers in this organization are being called heroes and the first responders, and their efforts to rescue civilians who have been terrorized by the war and conflicts in Syria. And the questions I have are simple. Mm-hmm. Who's being terrorized and by who? ISIS, the United States, NATO-backed Syrian rebel groups such as al-Nusra, or the democratically elected Assad government? And most of these activities that reached international attention were during the siege and violent conflict in the major Syrian city of Aleppo. You were there during the height of the warfare between Russian-supported government forces and the various anti-Assad pro-United States terrorist groups. So please take your time and share what you learned about who inflicted violence upon whom and who are the White Helmets, who funds them, and why we should be personally outraged at the mainstream media's lauding praise of this organization. The forum is yours.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gary. Well, first of all, I would like to make the point that the Syria Civil Defense is a fraudulent taking of the name of a Syrian state institution that has been in existence since 1953. It was established in 1953. In 1972, it became one of the founding members of the International Civil Defense Organization, whose headquarters are in Geneva and who has clear affiliations with the UN, OCHA, and various other civil defense bodies. That International Civil Defense Organization, that I have had conversations with them, have very clearly stated that they do not recognize the white helmets as the Syria civil defense. And in fact, that explains precisely one of the reasons that the white helmets were created. They were created primarily by the British government, who has put in the majority funding, followed as a close second by the United States, who have funded them through US aid and through one of their outreach funding sources, Chemonix. They were founded in Turkey, not in Syria, by a British ex-military mercenary, recently given the OBE by the British government, who trained them in Turkey, having previously been involved in various NATO state intervention campaigns, such as Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan. He went to Yemen in 2009. He has worked for and is still working for various euphemistically called private security firms. Among his network, we find the firm of Blackwater, which is famous under the Bush regime for having received an awful lot of money to carry out CIA assassinations to distance the United States administration and the deep state, the CIA, from killings that were being carried out on their behalf. That is extensively documented. Blackwater were then also funded a further $250 million by the Obama administration to continue this good work on behalf of the United States government and the CIA. So that is the area in which the trainer of the White Helmets, James Lemessurier, an ex-British military officer trained at Sandhurst, that's the area that he circulated in prior to coming to Istanbul to set up the White Helmets. He set up the White Helmets for three very good reasons. One was to basically disappear the Syrian state institution, the real Syria civil defense, in Western public perception. The real Syria civil defense continues to work in all civilian areas across Syria, not in the terrorist-held areas, but we have to remember that between 80 and 90% of Syrian civilians inside Syria are living in the government-held areas. So the real Syria civil defense services the majority of civilian areas inside Syria. That's a very important point to make. The White Helmets were, as I said, created to eradicate the existence of the Syrian state humanitarian first responders in Western public perception. They were then, of course, embedded in what corporate media in the West would call the rebel areas, what we would call the terrorist-controlled areas, controlled predominantly by Nusra Front and ISIS. Those are the only areas that you will find the White Helmets. So where the terrorists are, you will find the White Helmets. So they were embedded in those areas, so particularly in East Aleppo. From where the White Helmets were used to generate the propaganda, the narratives that enabled NATO state regimes, governments, to call for a no-fly zone, which was then reinforced by the corporate media and by the NATO-aligned NGOs, including the UN. So very much the White Helmets were created, as I said, just to summarize, to replace the Syrian state institution, to be embedded inside the so-called moderate rebel-held areas, which are effectively the terrorist-held areas, the militant extremists. And then they were there to produce the propaganda that facilitates greater military intervention inside Syria and to facilitate the basically the narrative that maintains the geopolitical strategy in Syria for regime change and to destabilize Syria in order to provide greater security for the US and EU ally in the Middle East, Israel. Coming back to East Aleppo and the liberation, you're quite right. I basically followed in the tracks of the Syrian Arab Army liberation and their allies, liberation of East Aleppo from what was effectively a Nusra Front and assorted around 27 or maybe even more assorted extremist factions, all of them funded by various EU, United States, Gulf states entities who were funding, arming, and equipping these militant factions, who for 4.5 years imprisoned, tortured, abused, violated, kidnapped, executed the Syrian civilians. So for 4.5 years, our corporate media were ramping up the propaganda against, as you say, the elected Syrian government under the humanitarian pretext of protecting and defending the rights of the Syrian people. In effect, what they were doing was actually muting the voices not only of the 110,000 civilians in East Aleppo, Syrian civilians, and amplifying, in fact, in reality, the voices of the terrorist and militant factions. They were also, again, in Western public perception, disappearing and completely erasing the voices of the majority 1.5 million Syrian people who were living in West Aleppo and who on an almost daily basis were coming under attack from hell cannon mortars, which are basically gas cylinders filled with glass, shrapnel, chemical weapons and explosives, and which were lobbed into West Aleppo. Sniper attacks, suicide bomb attacks, all manner of terrorist atrocities that were committed, as I said, on a daily basis for 4.5 years against the Syrian people, both in East Aleppo and in West Aleppo. 11,000 Syrian civilians, the majority of whom were children, were murdered by these Western-funded extremist factions embedded in East Aleppo, with whom the White Helmets were working closely, participating in these atrocities and facilitating them, supporting them in every way possible. When I spoke to civilians who, as I say, were emerging from this 4.5 year imprisonment, and when I asked them who the White Helmets were, did they know who they were? Had they come across them? Had they rescued any civilians, as they claimed universally for that 4.5 years? Every single one of them told me they didn't know who the White Helmets were, but they knew that there was a paramedic or a civil defense organization that worked exclusively with Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. Some said occasionally they might help civilians, but only if they really had to. The majority of the time they were exclusively supporting the terrorist groups inside East Aleppo. So one wonders, firstly, where these so-called rescue videos were filmed. My suggestion is, if these people who had actually been living alongside these White Helmets, so-called heroes, for 4.5 years, did not even recognize the term White Helmets. So in other words, that suggests that they had never seen these operatives wearing the White Helmets even. But they recognized them as wearing the civil defense uniform, but only working with Nusra Front. That raises many questions about the credibility of the videos that have been produced by the White Helmets, but also the material that has been used in the Netflix documentary and has just been awarded an Oscar, which you know, draws again attention to the fact that effectively what we have seen is corporate media in the West basing their narrative upon testimony from terrorist affiliates for the last 4.5 years in East Aleppo. And by the way, this has just been pretty much confirmed by a recent UN report that came out in the last 48 hours that has confirmed that hospitals were turned into prisons, into ammunition centers, into sniping towers, that schools the same were turned into Sharia courts, into military training centers, the basements were turned into prisons and into torture chambers. All of this I actually saw with my own eyes while I was in East Aleppo. The claim that the Syrian government, the elected Syrian government, was besieging and starving its own people was again another lie. Those who were starving these people were those terrorist factions. Humanitarian aid, both medicine and food, was available in East Aleppo, but it had been stockpiled and it had been kept exclusively for the terrorist and militant factions. The majority of the actual Syrian civilians were starving when they emerged from this 4.5 year imprisonment. They were not treated. They were not medically treated. For many of them, the first medical treatment they received was when they left East Aleppo and came to the Syrian government and Russian-controlled registration center, where they received medical help from the Russian medics who were there waiting for them, who were treating over 150 civilians per day, some of them with injuries that they'd received 4 years ago when the terrorist entities invaded East Aleppo, and they had not been treated during that 4 years. So many of them were coming out actually with limbs that had to be amputated because they had become gangrenous over a period of time of not being treated. So again, you know, this completely exposes the corporate media, our governments, the UN narrative as being at best horribly misinformed, at worst complete duplicitous lying in order to further their regime change agenda inside Syria.
I appreciate the overview. Thank you, Vanessa.
You're welcome.
What do you think when so-called liberal organizations, which are actually privatized entities such as Democracy Now!, then praise the White Helmets and give them a forum without offering you an opportunity to debate the issue openly and honestly? And when a John McCain, who has been photographed with terrorists, comes back and says that it's all a sod in a whole neoliberal community, which is the entirety of the Washington consensus, 400,000 corporations, consultants, and entities all need a continuation of conflict for them to continue the profiteering. And now you have a president who seems to be incapable of doing any discerning thought on this and to come to any independent decision. No one's looking at the fact that Assad was treated no different than Gaddafi, and they using one and the same people wanted Assad removed, and even though he represented no real or existential threat, are the same one who wanted Assad. So tell us about Assad. Do you have any proof that Assad intentionally starved the citizens of Aleppo? Do you have, as the liberal The Nation has stated, the magazine, that the Assad government was preventing humanitarian aid into the country, that Russia was bombing civilian targets as a hospital, and that also anything else where we have been told Assad did these what would be considered criminal acts and wars of war acts? Do you have proof of that?
No, absolutely not. And this is the important point. I'll come back to the humanitarian situation in East Aleppo, because for me, Aleppo actually represents very much a microcosm of exactly what is happening in all other areas of Syria and in Syria as a whole. First of all, let's consider the siege narrative. Syria is actually effectively under siege by our governments. 23 million Syrian people have been put under siege by our governments. And that includes crippling US-EU sanctions that are ensuring that the people of Syria are not receiving any medical aid via their own hospitals. They are not receiving humanitarian aid. They are not receiving fuel, electricity, clean water in many cases. And, you know, we had the recent situation where Wadi Barada, the spring that was supplying 5 million people in Damascus, had actually been taken over by Nusra Front-led various militant factions who had polluted the water initially and had then tried to destroy it to prevent 5 million people in Damascus receiving clean water. Now, this was not received, or this was not treated with the same level of outrage that, of course, we have with anything that will demonize the Syrian government or the Syrian army or any of the Syrian state institutions. But if we consider the fact that all of Syria is under siege from our governments, not only via the sanctions, but by the fact that they have flooded the country, infested the country with tens of thousands of extremist mercenaries and militants who are intent on ethnically cleansing the minorities in Syria, on destroying anything that stands both in the way of the NATO state and Gulf state political objective or geopolitical objectives inside Syria, but also anyone that stands in the way of their ideology. So this is what has been imposed upon Syria externally. As Mother Agnes said very clearly, between Syrians, there is no conflict. There is only solution. The conflict is coming in from outside. So that is, first of all, addressing that aspect of the siege. Secondly, if we bring it down a level, if we look at the sieges in Syria, there are two kinds of siege. First of all, which is what pretty much we had in East Aleppo, it's the occupation of an area by the terrorist factions. They occupy the area, and then when the Syrian government is allowing humanitarian aid, food or medicines into that area, those militant factions take control of the humanitarian aid and they deprive the Syrian civilians of that aid, or they will sell it to them at extortionate prices. That's siege number one. Siege number two is the terrorist factions, the militant factions, surrounding an area, as they have done with the two Shia Muslim villages in Idlib, Kafra and Fur, that have been under full siege from Ahrar al-Sham, Nusra Front, both of them funded by the United States and its allies, both of them armed by the United States and its allies, who have besieged these two villages since March 2015, full siege, and since 2011, partial siege. Now, over 1,800 civilians have been massacred in those villages, not talked about by corporate media. No humanitarian aid is being allowed in. Even the UN and the Red Cross admit that where an area is, if you like, besieged, because it is occupied by the terrorist factions, so it is besieged by the Syrian Arab Army, who will then try to create humanitarian corridors to allow civilians to exit before they try to move forward and retake areas that have been taken by the militant factions, right? I mean, that's logical. If it was the United States, they would just carpet bomb it, you know, as they did in Fallujah. So one has to actually respect that this is a country that is having a war imposed upon it, and the National Army, which is basically the Syrian people, every single Syrian family inside Syria has probably a member fighting for their defense in the Syrian Arab Army. So it's a slightly grotesque narrative to say that the Syrian army, which is the National Army of Syria, is going to basically deliberately kill or maim or rape or violate its own people, because they will be violating their own families. And that is a point which is obviously erased from public perception by the corporate media and by our regimes.
My final question, and a short answer if you would please. Look at the liberal media in the United States. It has not taken the effort to expose the very crimes of humanity that you're talking about and show the truth about our no-fly, wanting a no-fly zone, casting Russia as the enemy, casting Syria and Assad as the enemy, and the only solution being that we must have the removal of Assad, and using our so-called peaceful envoys in the area, such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, and Israel, as if these people represented true democracy and should have the power. I even heard that last night on Fox, and I've never seen in my life such dim-witted heads in talking heads anywhere. You would have to go to Mad Magazine to find caricatures that represent dumb worse than the dumb of Fox. That's on my own personal feelings, by the way. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I agree. Yeah, I mean, I think it's extraordinary. I mean, yes, look at what our governments are holding up as beacons for democracy in the region. Let's look at, very quickly, the alliance with Saudi Arabia. While they are working with Saudi Arabia to destabilize Syria and to destroy its culture, its heritage, its people, it is equally both the United States and the UK supplying billions of dollars of weapons, including cluster bombs, that are still in stock in Saudi Arabia, although I believe the United States has officially stopped supplying them, that are being used by the Saudi coalition to effectively ethnically cleanse, destroy, commit what is really a genocide against the Yemeni people, against 27 million Yemeni people, where the United States and the UK are sitting in the Riyadh Control and Command Center, enabling the Saudis to pick their targets, their civilian targets, to be hit with UK and US supplied bombs. So we can have absolutely no faith in our governments to be telling us that they are going into any sovereign nation, in other words, acting lawlessly under international law, violating the UN Charter Articles 1 and 2 on a humanitarian responsibility to protect pretext, because that is about the furthest from their agenda as it can possibly be.
Okay. I want to thank you, Vanessa, for your courageous work over there and having the courage to tell the truth, as many journalists do not. And I'm going to invite you back if you have an opportunity to do a whole hour where we can talk about Yemen and the genocide occurring in Yemen by our hidden hand and the Saudis and other people, and also what role Israel has been playing in this since you have been in the territories and you have a different perspective than what the American media is used to sharing when it comes to the so-called only country in the Middle East that's democratic in principle, Israel, and share your points of view. All right?
Yeah, I would love to, Gary. Thank you so much for having me on.
All the best to you in your travels. Vanessa Beely, B-E-E-L-E-Y. She's our guest, and we're happy to have had her on. And go to the website, thewallwillfall.org, as well as 21stcenturywire.com. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.